The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Margaret Kimberly is the guest this week, and we discuss Black Anger and Black Lives Matter on this week's episode. Margaret is a regular columnist for the Black Agenda Report, as well as being a regular guest on this podcast. We also discuss broken window policing, Michael Eric Dyson, white racism, police brutality, and the politics and the anti-politics of Black Lives Matter. It's Thursday, July 21st, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to take a moment to let you know that next month's releases from Zero Books includes Daniel Coffeen's Reading the Way of Things. If you're a longtime listener to my podcast, then you're probably familiar with Daniel Coffeen. His Deleuzian Guide to Reading the World is available in paperback and as an ebook. I also want to announce that our membership site is about halfway to completion and that Coffeen has volunteered to be one of the first authors to lead our upcoming Zero Books philosophy workshops. This episode includes clips from Glenn Lowry's Blogging Head TV show. There's also a clip from Heather McDonald discussing her book, The War on the Cops, as well as a clip of Jack Nicholson and A Few Good Men. Right now you're listening to the Vaporwave artist Macintosh Plus. And if you're a fan of Vaporwave or want to learn more about it, you might pick up Grafton Tanner's book, Babbling Corpse, which was published in June by Zero Books. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Margaret Kimberly and I discuss Black Anger and Black Politics. So you recently wrote a piece in response to the shootings in Baton Rouge and Minnesota, and then the Dallas protest and mass shooting there. What was the name of that? The title of your piece in the Black Agenda Report on that?
The title of my piece was "Why We Need Black Anger."
Right.
Shortly after. We saw the videos of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile being killed by police within about 48 hours. And it was very traumatic for black people. I think it was shocking to everyone else. But for us, it was just the trauma of seeing this again, knowing this happens all the time, but seeing it again. And there was an expression of mostly of anger, which I feel is a good thing. But then, within a couple of days of Castile's murder, five cops were shot to death in Dallas, Texas, during a protest march, which is being called a Black Lives Matter march. I don't know if it was. It's I feel like any time black people protest, it's said to be a Black Lives Matter march, whether it is or isn't. Right. But at any rate, there was a protest, and there is a suspect who himself was killed by the police, who was literally blown up by the police using a bomb disposal device, which they attached a bomb to and blew him up without charge, trial, without arrest or anything.
Yeah.
So, but the story of the police took over, and the same people who had been showing anger suddenly censored themselves or felt compelled to say they were sorry that the police were dead. Even Alton Sterling's family felt compelled to say they didn't want any violence. And I was disturbed by that because we need anger. I mean, as individuals, we need to acknowledge our anger, and as groups, we need to acknowledge our anger about this lack of justice, this refusal to bring justice to people. There are more than 1,000 people. I believe last year the number was 1,134. That's a number that sticks in my mind, according to The Counted, which is the Guardian newspaper's efforts to count police murder victims, because the Justice Department won't do it, by the way. So that's 3 people every day who are killed by the police. And without generally any charges being filed, or even if they are, they're found innocent, or if they're found guilty, they're let off with a slap on the wrist. And people need to feel free to show their anger and didn't have to say anything about the police being shot in Dallas. I think the anger is good enough, and that should lead to a demand for justice from the top, from President Obama, who has thus far refused to find cause to prosecute not even one police officer in all his years in office.
I wanted to inquire about black anger and to follow that up a bit more. But before I do that, you said something really interesting, which is that anytime black people get on the streets and protest, that's considered Black Lives Matter. And which is really interesting. I can't think of another movement that could make such a broad claim on a group of people. Like anytime white people get on the street, it's not always anything, right? So can you think of a protest movement that involves primarily black people today that isn't affiliated with Black Lives Matter?
Well, yeah, I don't know that this march in Dallas had organizers, but I don't believe there was any
What is Black Lives Matter?
Announcement.
You know, I mean.
Well, that's, you know, I find them somewhat. Let me just say this. The organization Black Lives Matter, I find problematic because they are very apolitical. They seized upon this anger. The 3 founders, they say that they were galvanized by the acquittal of George Zimmerman and the killing of Trayvon Martin. And they coined this term, which caught on for very obvious reasons, and it spoke to what black people feel, that our lives do not matter, that they never have, unless it was for somebody's profit. And so clearly, these were words that were tailor made for this moment. And in addition to that, the fact that they were attacked and that the name was attacked by many white people who felt uncomfortable or said, well, all lives matter, or cop lives matter, or to further diminish this feeling, I think has catapulted them into being identified with every effort in the issue of police brutality. They say they're a diffuse organization. They don't really have a head. They don't really have anything central. I have problems with that. I think, as we've discussed before, that I think that was an issue, frankly, that brought down the Occupy movement.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that.
So, you know, you had people on their own confronting Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or whomever and calling themselves Black Lives Matter, and were they or were they not acting for the rest of the group, and so on and so forth. But they are lacking in making any political demand, and that is my issue with Black Lives Matter, that they won't say what I just said about President Obama. But the words have caught on, and it's for that reason. So, I mean, in a way, it's a good thing that anybody anywhere can protest and say this is a Black Lives Matter protest. That's a matter of principle in defending black people's lives. But it is problematic also. And now you have this situation where the organization has more credibility than I believe it deserves. So nobody wants to hold an event, a march, a rally. Everyone asks, is Black Lives Matter invited? Is Black Lives Matter going to be there? And, you know, that's not a bad thing, but they have been permitted to in a sense, take over the whole the fight against police brutality. And so that because I have issues with the organization, not with the words and the thought behind it.
I'm unclear still about what kind of organization we're talking about, because we have a hashtag that's Black Lives Matter. We have a kind of a slogan, Black Lives Matter, which isn't very different in my mind from, say, the 1% versus the 99% as a slogan. It's just like a it's a slogan. That's all. Then there's an actual a nonprofit group, a political organization, a party. What is Black Lives Matter as an organization?
Yeah, that's I'm not too sure, and I think that is a problem. They had a. I'm not sure who funds them, frankly. They have to be very well funded, though. They had a conference, a convening, as they called it, last summer in Cleveland. And I was concerned. I looked at the list of the sessions and the workshops, and there was a lot of emphasis on people's feelings and healing and safe spaces. And there were only one or two workshops that dealt with political action. And that kind of sealed it for me. With them, that they have seized upon this almost unanimous opinion that something has to be done without actually showing a way forward. And then, of course, they get credibility because they're attacked by people like Rudy Giuliani or, you know, Rush Limbaugh. So then they're defended without, I think, really. I mean, how hard is it really to be attacked by Rudy Giuliani or Rush Limbaugh? It doesn't really amount to much. You know, any black person doing anything is attacked by them. So, but if you're attacked by the right people, you get credibility with it.
I think you can be a right-wing Republican and maybe, you know, sitting in the Senate and not get attacked by Rush Limbaugh and be black. Possibly. I think that's possible.
Yeah.
But otherwise, otherwise, you're kind of screwed if you want to have, you know, Rush Limbaugh's good favor. So now you said some, you know, the thing is Black Lives Matter is not only about, as you just mentioned, it's not only about ending police brutality and police murder. It's also about a variety of other things. It was taken up by campus movements to be about ending campus racism, ending discrimination on campus, creating safe spaces for the black communities on campuses, and at times that I think it was very misguided, attacking administrators who wrote emails they didn't like and worrying about Halloween costumes. These are all things that are associated now with Black Lives Matter. In that sense, you know, there's the organization, whatever it may be, and the funding that goes to it, but then there's the idea of it and the hashtag. And I think in that way, it's fair to say that the people who were on the streets in Dallas were out in the name of, or, you know, as a part of the broad slogan and movement that is Black Lives Matter. Just like if there was a protest against Wall Street. I mean, like, just like when we did protests here in Portland, some of us may have been talking to Occupy Wall Street in New York, but everybody didn't have to have a connection in order to be out and for Occupy. Does that make sense?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So they're saying something needs to be done, saying we cannot tolerate what we have, which is absolutely where you have to start when you want to make radical change. But then this group doesn't have any way of making a positive contribution towards political change.
Right. Yeah, they don't have a political platform. And that is their weakness. And I can't conjecture why they don't, but the fact is that they do not. And in the absence of a political platform, in the absence of an attack on, and I mean a rhetorical attack on people in power, like the president, in the end, what good are they? I mean, aside from, and I'm not opposed to protests, who knows, they may do some good. It may, somewhere, someone may not have been brutalized or killed because there was a march and there was attention called to police conduct. But, you know, that's very iffy. So that's not something you can prove. There haven't been so far this year. The U.S. is on track to have the same number of police killings as last year. So and no more prosecutions than there were last year.
Right.
So ultimately, you have to ask, whether they are effective or not at fighting what it is they say they want to fight.
I'm looking up here, like actual political platforms, and there's associated with Black Lives Matter, there's this group called Campaign Zero, which has like a 10-point plan of the end the broken windows, policing policy, community oversight, limits to the use of force, blah, 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 blah. They have 10 points, and some of them seem, they're all very practical, you know, and sort of technocratic in ways that I don't think are bad. Like, I think ending the broken windows policing would be a way to end a lot of the harassment of Black people in their communities. And that hopefully also in the violence.
Yeah, it's kind of their platform is a bit. I'm not impressed with it, frankly. You know, there are people calling for community control of the police. They have said I have not seen a detailed description of what that would look like, but I think that is a better start to say that. Every community should have the right to hire, to fire, to prosecute the police officers who are patrolling their streets. So there should be, and not civilian complaint review boards, because those are a joke. In Los Angeles, they recently determined that every police interaction was lawful and fair and reasonable, and nobody had ever done anything wrong. So, you know, they judged themselves and found themselves innocent. So that's the kind of thing that civilian complaint review boards inevitably turn into. But there has to be a call for that, for community control of the police and a political demand. Or, for example, don't vote for people who are in favor of that. I mean, that it has to be something concrete. And not the, you know, Campaign Zero, very wishy-washy stuff. So here in New York City, I think people could start saying, don't vote for Bill de Blasio again. He got into office at about the time that Black Lives Matter took off and implied he was going to stop the police stop and frisk policy, and it has diminished since Mayor Bloomberg, but it still exists. There's still police harassment. Broken windows is still an official policy. So I think here in New York, an example of that could be don't vote for him again. And don't be afraid to say, oh, they could have a Republican in office, or, you know, what good does he do? So, or stop supporting the Democrats, or start a new political party. It could be a variety of things, but it has to be something that is confrontational. Because that is what gets results, is confrontation. There was a story that broke in the last week or so about a man who worked at Yale University who broke a window, a stained glass window at Calhoun College. And who knew how Yale University was set up? But apparently they have these colleges. And John C. Calhoun, one of the worst, one of the biggest leaders of the slaveocracy, in the middle 1800s, there's a Yale alumnus, and this college is named for him. And they had these stained glass windows depicting slavery, Black people picking cotton and so forth. And despite years of complaints, Yale did nothing about it. And this man who worked there, who was a dishwasher, a Black man named Menifee, his last name, he got angry and broke the window. And so they're taking the windows out. And at first he was arrested, but Yale has said they will not press charges against him. So the pleas and the discussions and the committees and the task forces and whatever did nothing. The man got angry and broke the window and now they're gone. So it's that kind of confrontation that I think gets results. And now we're seeing with the police killed in Dallas, and I don't know if you saw the news this morning, police were shot in Baton Rouge. And there are conflicting reports about how many were killed. Some news, I'm trying to find good sources. Some say two cops were killed, some say three. But that is a cry for justice. And I, you know, and the next time Obama wants to go to a cop's memorial service, somebody needs to say to him, well, this is because of you.
I have a question about those windows. The windows ties into that broken window policing policy, which is such a huge problem.
Ironically, yeah. Right.
But you said that approach works, and it did get rid of the windows, but I don't see that having a political impact in the long term. Maybe just symbolically it has some impact, but I don't see that that's going to change anything for anyone in that community, really, to have those windows be gone, except that they're offensive to look at.
Right. Well, that does send a signal. I mean, by keeping them there,
but who does it send? Who does it send a signal to? I mean, who is it? Do you think?
It sends a signal.
Go ahead.
Whoever at Yale University was afraid to take them down. What I know about institutions like that, they have very wealthy alumni. They have billion-dollar endowments and so forth, and the president and other leadership there didn't want to offend them. People have these ties to these institutions, and they, these are some of the most retrograde institutions in the country, these big, wealthy universities. But despite the fact that it was offensive, Yale did not want to offend someone else, someone with money and power, somebody who writes a big check. I'm of course, guessing that it wouldn't come out and say this. But so the hurt that it caused other people, ultimately, despite their fancy words, didn't matter. They didn't care that it was offensive to other people until someone got angry and did something about it. So I think that does count. And I think it's an indication of, and, no one knows where to draw the line. You break a window or shoot a police officer. It's, these are, quite different. With things to do, but I bet the point is for people to take action, and that is what taking action gets at.
Well, okay, I want to respond to this one a little bit more, because I'm not, I'm sure I would have hated those windows too, right? But I just feel like if I was a working class guy, working class black guy around that area and was looking for work, that those windows wouldn't be big on my mind, that in getting rid of them wouldn't necessarily help me the next week. And not just a working class guy, but just if you're somebody who's getting beaten up by bullies because of your race, that those windows going down probably wouldn't stop that from happening either. And the problem is, when you say this is a successful approach and that this kind of action can work, it did work to get the windows gone, but it gives people on the right some fodder. They can say, look at these black people. No one's doing anything to them. They can, they break the property and no one presses charges. They're just out of control. That's what guys like Rush Limbaugh will say. And you're suffering that kind of, attack. For what? For what? For some windows. I mean,
we get attacked anyway.
Yeah.
There comes a time when you have to. Especially considering the source,
if you want to win, you don't want to get attacked on things that you can't. You don't want to risk a counterattack for nothing. You want to risk a counterattack.
Yeah, this guy, he won. They were afraid enough of the bad publicity that they decided not to press charges against him. But the university could have taken a hard line and had him prosecuted. But I think we also have to honor people who are willing to go out on a limb, whether it's always.
I'm not upset with that guy at all. I mean, I understand where that's coming
from.
I'm just saying that may not be our best example for a tactic going forward.
Maybe not that particular. Yeah, but these images, these things like that are very important. I know someone in Florida, St. Petersburg, Florida, who in the early 70s, his name is Omali Yeshitela from Black is Back Coalition. There was a racist depiction of black people in the city hall in St. Petersburg, and he took it down and he went to jail. He went to jail for several years. He came out, still ready to fight the system. But that is something that has to be discussed, because this man broke a window. He could have gone to jail. Yale could have chosen to prosecute him. like O'Malley was prosecuted. These police shootings, the guy in Dallas ended up dead himself. There's no suspect's name named in this shooting this morning in Baton Rouge. But this person could be shot. Or I thought of, just letting it play out in my mind, the black community, I'm sure, will be targeted. And perhaps someone else will be a victim of brutality or even murder because of the one person who did this. So trying to determine whether to act and how to act, but I just think people need to go in with their eyes open and know that there could be suffering by the person who takes the action or by someone else. But my hope is that this sort of thing also will get the attention of people in power. And because sometimes that's all they understand and all they care about is direct action of some kind.
Cobb stats spread nationwide. Departments across the country now send officers to emerging crime spots to try to interrupt criminal behavior before it happens. No other government program has come close to data-driven policing's success as an economic stimulus. Welfare, forget about it. If you want to turn communities around, you have got to bring down crime. In New York City, businesses that had shunned previously drug-infested neighborhoods now set up shop there, offering residents choice in shopping and jobs for local workers. Senior citizens felt safe to go out to the store or the post office to pick up their Social Security check. Children could ride their bikes on sidewalks without their mothers worried that they would be shot. But the crime victories of the last two decades are now in jeopardy, thanks to the falsehoods of the Black Lives Matter movement. There are signs that law and order and the moral support for such order are breaking down. Police operating in inner city neighborhoods now find themselves routinely surrounded by cursing, jeering crowds when they make a pedestrian stop or try to arrest a suspect. Sometimes bottles and rocks are thrown. Cops are worried about becoming the latest racist cop of the week and possibly losing their livelihood thanks to an incomplete cell phone video that inevitably fails to show the antecedents to their own use of force. Officer use of force is never lovely to see. But the public is clueless about how hard it is to subdue somebody who is determined to resist arrest. Cops will tell you it can take 5 to 6 officers. As a result of the anti-cop campaign of the last 2 years and the resulting pushback on the streets,
who's going to do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who...
Like, this moment where you had these police murders, not the murders of policemen, but the murders done by the police. And then that you had the mass shooting and the kill and the murder of policemen in Dallas, and it was almost like a stalemate at that point. As you pointed out, that the anger didn't go anywhere because of that, of the mass shootings, and it sort of lost its moral it lost the moral high ground after that. That the outrage is still there, it just it doesn't have the stage now because it lost out in the realm of publicity or PR, I suppose. right around the time that the shootings in Dallas had, right after they had happened, the number two book on Amazon was a book called The War on Cops, How the New Attack on Law and Order Makes Everyone Less Safe. And it was a book that about the Ferguson effect and how, which, you know, goes back to this, how basically because of the fear of repercussions from doing their job, according to Heather McDonald, who wrote this book, cops are no longer on the streets stopping crime, you know, and fighting for truth, justice in the American way or whatever. And so now obviously the Ferguson effect is highly speculative. You can't really point it out. And even if it's true to some degree, you know what would really stop crime is if everyone was locked in their house. You know, like it just because crime goes up and down doesn't mean that the policy that's keeping crime subdued is justifiable, right? So, but nonetheless, it's important to realize that a good portion of the at least reading public on Amazon was attracted to this book, The War on Cops, and that it's not only, you know, the fight between people who want to say all lives matter and the people who want to say Black Lives Matter, it's not the only fight in town. There's this other fight between people who want to say the cops, you know, take the handcuffs off the cops, that kind of thing.
The facts don't bear that out. You know, police have not stopped arresting people. They haven't stopped killing people. And police work is, by the way, not a dangerous occupation. I mean, construction work is more dangerous. More people die in construction work accidents than police. It's something like 20-some-odd cops killed in the line of duty in the past year. Let's say it was 30, as opposed to 1,100 people killed by the police. So there's no equivalence there. But Heather McDonald from the Manhattan Institute, famous right-wing pundit, she would say that. But it does point out the popularity of this book, points out the popularity of police surveillance and brutality. During the years of when Stop and Frisk was so bad here in New York City, every poll showed that most white people thought Stop and Frisk was fine. They, because it wasn't directed at them. And I think it's seen as a price to pay to keep black people under physical control. And by the way, all those 1,100 people who killed are not black. It's like a third of them are black. There's a fair number of white people who are killed by the police every year. And, you know, more than any, there are other countries that have never had 1,000 police killings ever in their existence. And this happens every single year in the United States since people have been paying attention and trying to keep count. But the fact that some white people will be caught up in this police state seems to be a price that others are willing to pay, because of the overriding desire they have for black people to be the ones under control.
Well, it, you know, the thing is, the argument would go in New York that the stop and frisk policy and the you know, broken window policy brought crime down, and there's just no arguing against the fact that the crime rate has dropped significantly, like by 40 or 50%. Since these policies were instituted, whether or not that's causation or correlation, you can't really say, right? I mean, I don't know. But, yeah, and it's and white people in New York were glad to have black people pay the consequences to bring these rates down, right? But you're right that 50% or a little more than half of the people who die each year at the hands of the cops are whites. And then the second largest demographic would be blacks, right? You know, at 40% or something. Right. Of course, blacks are 13% of the population, so it's hugely disproportionate. And,
yeah.
But the point is, I feel like we have to have an argument in order to really address police brutality and really address the problem. We have to have an argument about crime. We have to say, look, in order to bring the crime, there are two ways to bring the crime rates down. One is to institute harsher and harsher penalties, harsher and harsher policies, militarize the police, and suppress freedom. The other is to create a more equitable, livable society. And, you know, that second thing, we have to make a case for that. We have to maybe go around the problem. It's not going to be addressed directly by going to the cops. We have to change the policies for the cops. We have to change the policies on the streets and in our, you know, workplace.
Right. Well, people in this, we Americans forget, even though we're the world's number one jailer with more than 2 million people incarcerated, most of those people are not in jail for committing any violent act.
Right.
It's drug offenses. There are people who go to jail for, you know, we literally call it a debtor's prison, but there are places in this country where you can be arrested because you didn't pay a debt or don't go to court. That was one of the things that was found in Ferguson. In addition to the happy cops, black people were fined for all sorts of things and sometimes put in jail if they couldn't pay.
These cops are often doing things which they would be less inclined to do if dealing with a white equivalent exhibiting the same behavior. And if that weren't true, I would be one of the first people to be taking my lumps by saying so. But I don't know, Glenn. I am unaware of anybody on any side of the spectrum who has presented a very simple list of white, lower class men who have been not just harassed, I've seen those lists, but killed in their cars, running away, these same things, in this same way. It simply isn't true that there's a narrative along the lines of what's going on with these black men that's going on with white men, too, that the media somehow suppresses or that we're being asked not to pay attention to. Because if that were the case, especially with the media the way it is now, we'd know. And so this is something that happens to black people more. And I think it is thoroughly reasonable to suppose that color has to do with these split-second decisions. Now, no, the police are not running around trying to off black men. It's not a war on black men. But there's a racial element here. And the way I think of the cops is, and I've said this
and
since
I said that I haven't seen a list of white guys who die under these same seamy conditions where they really shouldn't have died at all. And I said not just one or two cases. I want the list. And we kind of left it at that. And, you know, right away I started getting people sending me first, you know, two people, three people. Everybody kept on saying, this is the beginning.
Yeah.
And frankly, I thought to myself, no, this is the end. If that's all you could find, then there's no list. But then more things started coming down the pike, including from you. And you put me onto Peter Moskos' blog. And I am not ashamed that I didn't know about it because no one tells us. You had to dig for that list. I don't happen to read Peter Moskos' blog. What does a typical American know? What do these Black Lives Matter people know? What does the woman crying over her child on the street know? She doesn't know about the list because the mainstream media doesn't put it out there. So I decided, to the extent that I at least pretend to be mainstream media, I'm going to put out the list. And so that was my time piece this week.
Yeah, John, let me just tell people, I want you to go into some of the detail in their piece, that Peter Moskos is a professor of criminal justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, and his blog is called copinthehood.com. So anyway, go ahead, John, tell us about, and this list that John is talking about is that he had said, I had said, There are twice as many white people as black people killed by police in this country every year. John Wilson said, okay, then where's your list, man? They shot like Walter Scott. They shot like Trayvon Martin. You give me the list.
Proportionately, more black people are killed unarmed and innocent by the cops each year than white. The numbers overall are rather modest, but yes, that is true. Nevertheless, the list of white men who were killed this way goes on and on. And what's interesting about it is how similar the circumstances are to the sort of stories that are common now. There was a guy, Loren Simpson, L-O-R-E-N, and he's in a van. And
I want to talk to you about race, like white and black race, because I want to talk to you about Michael Eric Dyson's column, Death in Black and White. And I found this column to be, it made me angry, this column. And I know that, you know, it was meant to. So I'm just falling right into the trap, maybe. But I felt that it was divisive in a way that was not at all helpful. And I think of it as sort of a kind of an anti-racist politics that's really a diversion. I wonder if focusing on white attitudes and white opinion and even white privilege the way Dyson does is a diversion away from the kind of conversation we're having where we're trying to talk about a political action to make actual change. What did you make of his column?
Well, I agree with you. He's a problematic person. He's one of these people who I call, someone called him, and I wish I could remember who said it so I could give them credit, called him a spokes Negro. He's one of these people who gets a lot of mileage, a lot of good gigs, writes books, columns, comes on TV explaining black people to white people. He was a big fan of Obama, bragged about going to the White House.
Yeah.
Said Hillary Clinton, and then he says things that just are bizarre. He attacked Cornel West in this, as long as a book, and this column, and it was all about, frankly, helping Hillary Clinton. He signed on with Hillary. So he's a professor. He's a good writer, a prolific writer. But good at writing is what I mean to say, not that I like what he says. So anyway, that's a little background on him. But you're right. It was this plaintive wail that I'm frankly kind of tired of, where a black person makes the case for white people to be nicer, and to understand why black people might be angry, and hoping that white people change what they do instead of directing, frankly, the conversation among black people about what we ought to do. And I think that's something that's missing now. And I think, frankly, Obama being president is part of that problem. So that he says, for example, we have rage, we keep it inside. We're afraid for our tears to flow, and we damage our own bodies with high blood pressure and depression. And that's technically true, but that needs to, if you're going to write in the New York Times about that, you should say we need to, as I tried to say, we need our anger, and we need to start making demands. And he ends with, we can't hate you because that's our gift to you. What the hell does that mean?
That's just a lie. Black people have no trouble hating white people, and white people have no trouble hating black people. And then to say, and we can't halt you. I mean, Jesus Christ, are you just okay? So why write a column if you can't change anything?
Exactly. It's, we cannot hate you. It's like, well, speak for yourself.
Right.
People, and that's the thing I've noticed lately. People who, before would not say they hated white people, or they're coming out and saying it. And every outrage increases that willingness for people to speak up. So he's speaking for himself.
I don't think it's a good thing to encourage racial hate from either side, right? But certainly it is there, and we can't just pretend like it doesn't.
Exactly, and it's there because of the continued assault and from the lack of redress.
But I want to say something about this idea that white people just don't get it. We said earlier 50% of the people who are killed each year by the police are white. And look, I've had trouble with the cops. Not like I would have if I was black, probably, but I've had trouble with the cops. And I watched Aaron Gardner die, and I didn't think, oh, I don't understand. He's black. That doesn't mean – I looked and I say, shit, that could be me. I'm kind of an overweight 45. I mean, it was my age. If a cop did that to me, I'd die, And I have a kid who's 19, and I saw a kid get tased by the cops for like 4 minutes. So this kid was 17, and he had a heart attack. And went into a coma because this cop tased him for 4 minutes, dragged him out of the car, and just threw him to the curb like he was a bag of trash. And and that kid was a white kid that happened to. So people can understand this. It's not like this is heavy math.
But that's a question. Who said Bob Dole? Where is the outrage? Where is the outrage when these numbers became, because it was something that people knew about an individual, an anecdotal instance in their town where they witnessed something or they heard about something where they live. But now we know how bad the United States is in police brutality, that it outranks, and it's not surprising, the world's number one jailer, the two are connected. But where is the outrage for that young man, for the other people who were killed? I suspect that, though, and I am guessing here, that the white people who are killed by police are the people who are not wanted, that they're probably homeless or, you know, drugs or something like that, that makes them easier to be, to defend the police and say that so-and-so deserves this. But for people to just turn a blind eye and not be outraged about this this rate of murder is pretty shocking. But I don't know that it's something that people are necessarily conscious of either. I think there is a lot of unconscious acceptance of things that are terrible in this country.
Do you ever see them, the Star Trek episode where there's an ongoing war between two planets, but it's been all done by computer now? So they have to just, every once in a while, you're just called upon to go to the suicide chamber. It's sort of like that. We have this, because it could hit anybody. Police violence that's completely unjustified, you know, it doesn't hit just anyone on the same, you know, statistically it doesn't, but it could actually just hit anybody, right? You could be in the wrong place at the wrong time. A cop can shoot you out of anger and you die and he'll get away with it or not, but you'll be dead. That could happen, but we accept it because we accept this society as it is, and the society as it is requires that the state has the right to be violent, you know, and the right to be violent first without justification.
And I think too, the unconscious, you know, I'm not saying on any conscious racist, there are many people who are quite consciously openly racist, but I think there the unconscious racism, which tells everybody, it's, you know, it's just like an unwritten thing that everybody knows, the police protect us, meaning white people, the normative we being white. And they keep us safe. So it's, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. And but yeah, it's too bad about so-and-so, about this case and that case. But overall,
they're keeping the angry hordes at bay. So we have to have them on that line. Yeah. No, I mean, that's absolutely the case, that people think that way, especially in certain areas. I mean, it's not so such a prominent thought, I think, like in Portland, Oregon. But then again, Portland, Oregon doesn't have much of a black community at all. So, you know, right?
Yeah.
So we don't have to think that way. I come from the South. I remember my uncle saying that he was really concerned about two things. One, the liberals taking power and giving, being too lenient, and there's needing to be more law and order, and two, the Republicans cutting black people's welfare, because then they'll be, you know, they'll come to his house and steal his wife and children or something. I don't know, but he was like,
but he wanted welfare to be protected.
Yeah, welfare was just as important for him, to protect him from black people, as his gun and his his bedside table and the cops. So it's interesting to think about. My racist uncle, he was not a mean, you know, like truck driving macho guy. He was like totally second fiddle in that house. It was my aunt who ran the house. He was a mild little mouse of a man, but he was driven by these fears. He wasn't, you know, I mean, and you watch some of these shootings, like did you see the guy that got shot at like a gas station or 7-Eleven, and the cop tells him to get out of the car, and he does, and then the cop tells him, you know, get your license, so he turns around and bends into the car to get the license, and the cop shoots him four times?
Yes.
That cop was not angry. That cop was not looking to shoot a black person. That cop was scared silly by a black guy, is what it was. And, you know, should never have been given a gun, should never have been sent out anywhere to manage anything. But That's what that was. So racism can look like fear is another thing that's interesting.
Well, I'm sure it does. I see these cops, especially these young rookie cops in New York, like, and I always tell when they've just unleashed a new class of cops, because you see these young cops in uniform and they're afraid.
Yeah.
See them in Harlem or, you know, Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and they're afraid. So, you know, racism, it is a fear.
Yeah.
Also, but it can come out in aggression. I think these cops, you know, and people talk about police training and improving training, and I think that could be helpful. But there's another training I think that's already gone on about your uncles being afraid of black people. So if you are afraid that there's this group that are going to take something from you, or you just don't want them around, then you are more likely to pull that trigger, even subconsciously. But even having said that, I think that would be less likely to happen if police knew they could be punished.
Oh, yeah.
I think it would keep some of that in check.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Although, yeah, I mean, I think in that case with that kid should never have been given a gun. There was a dashboard cam. I think he lost his job and you know,
I don't know the guy didn't. And the case I'm thinking of, the man, thank God, didn't die.
No, he didn't.
The cop was fired.
Yeah.
But that happens all too often. You know, and I think about what we see in these videos, and it's like, what do we not see?
Right.
What's going on that isn't being filmed? And then it's like, you know, even when things are filmed, it doesn't seem to matter.
I'm really hoping that something good will come out of, I mean, not that something good will come out of the shooting in Minnesota, and that this guy will, that these people will be held accountable. But one last question I had here, and this is a big one, and then we'll wrap it up. But do you think that there would be a mass movement like Black Lives Matter to protest the murders at the hands of the cops if the killings were distributed evenly across racial lines?
I think if you know, you talked about the disproportionality where 1/3 of the police murder victims, but, you know, like a little more than 10% of the population. If those 1,100 people who die every year, and I don't know what percentage the country is white, whatever, let's say it's, I don't know, 75%. I am totally guessing.
I've heard that, yeah. Something like that.
If it is, if there were, you know, 750 white police murder victims, it might. I mean, it's the same way with the prison system. I mean, the reason that rehabilitation is not an issue and that people are swept up for and given very harsh sentences for minor infractions is because it affects mostly us. So I think if the pain was shared more equally, I think it could help. But why does that not happen? Why does it have to be that way? Why does it have to be more white people suffering?
If you don't distribute the pain evenly, then you don't get everyone unified to fight back and to make a change, because it becomes like a minority issue. It becomes, you know, these people can shoulder the burden. So I guess that's right. I tend to think that if it was evenly distributed, it would just become invisible again. But I'm probably wrong there. I think that's a completely, I can't justify that thought.
I don't know. There has to be a wholesale change of so many things in this country that are accepted. And I don't know what it would take to bring that about. But I think without the discussion, we will have more of the same.